You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, July the 6th. Good to have you with us and hope you'll join in as we review the news of the week. It's our Friday Week in Review when we invite two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week. And we are very happy to have with us Ruth Conniff and Owen Robinson today. And we hope you will call in with your news of the week, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We will talk about all the news of the week on a state level, national level, international level as well, most likely starting with the pardon, or I shouldn't say the pardon, I made a slip up there, the commutation of Louis Libby's prison sentence by President Bush this week. Let me welcome in our guests. Owen Robinson, conservative blogger for bootsandsabers.com, a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And also joining us, Ruth Conniff, political editor for the Progressive Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Haven't talked to you in a while. Good to have you back.
Good to be here.
And also always good to talk to you, Owen.
Well, thank you.
The president is sparing former White House aide Louis Scooter Libby from a 30-month prison term, saying the sentence is excessive. Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff was convicted in March of lying and obstructing the investigation into the 2003 leak of the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame, the wife of Iraq war critic Joe Wilson. Here's President Bush earlier this week.
I felt the punishment was severe. So I made a decision that would commute his sentence, but leave in place a serious fine and probation. As to the future, I'm, rule nothing in and nothing out.
Ruth Conniff, your reaction?
Well, now, I like Paul Krugman's reaction in the New York Times this morning. Now we know what Bush meant when he said that any leakers found in his administration at the beginning of this whole thing would be taken care of. He has certainly taken care of Scooter Libby. It's just rank hypocrisy. It's outrageous that he's taking this pass. He was convicted. He clearly committed the crime. And to say that it's excessive, it doesn't sit well coming from an administration that has worked so hard to push for mandatory minimums for other convicted criminals. So, there's a whole slew of reasons why it's outrageous. But, another interesting consequence of it is that it opens up this whole can of worms. So now lawyers for other people who are not getting this kind of kid gloves treatment are going to be filing what one law professor called the Libby motion, saying my client should get this kind of special treatment.
Owen Robinson, outrageous?
No, I don't think so. I think that clearly it has some political consequences, but quite frankly, Bush is at a position in his approval rating and in his term where it really doesn't matter. This isn't going to hurt him politically at all. I've heard a lot of talk from the left regarding the rule of law. This is thwarting the rule of law, and frankly, that's a load of bunk because Bush is acting perfectly within his executive rights to commute sentences and pardon people. It's a check and balance over the judiciary that the executive branch has, and he's perfectly within his authority. And frankly, Bush doesn't have to give a reason, much like Clinton didn't have to give a reason when he pardoned Mark Rich, just because he was his buddy. Sure, he pays some political consequences for it, took some heat on the Sunday morning shows, and Bush is doing the same, but he's clearly within his legal authority.
Well, yes, he can step in and get the punishment waived, but in terms of talking about the rule of law, it's really that phrase became such a knee-jerk part of our national dialogue during the Clinton administration when Republicans were up in arms about Clinton's perjury on whether or not he had an affair in the White House. And to say to say that in this case, where there's clearly a cover-up going on, where now that Scooter Libby's not looking at jail time, we may never know anymore about this whole plot that clearly extends at least to the vice president's desk, it's so much more serious, and yet the tables are turned, and it's okay.
Well, to be fair, Fitzgerald investigated this for years and has tons of people on record, including the reporters to whom the information was leaked, I don't think there's much more to discover about this so-called plot, and Libby being in jail certainly wouldn't bring out any more information. If he was going to flip anybody, as you seem to think he might, he would have done it by now. And I would just suggest that a $250,000 fine is by no means light, and the first person who has paid such a fine can talk about how light a sentence that is.
Well, you know, not everybody's in the position that Scooter Libby's in. You know, he's paid off the fine already yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredible. And, you know, there is a network of fundraisers and right-wing think tanks that are going to step up and help him out. And, that has been said, you know, it was said sort of throughout the analysis of this decision. And in this morning's New York Times, there are columnists who say, you know, we shouldn't feel sorry for him because he's going to get his friends will help him pay the fine. Well, they're out of date. You know, by press time, the fine was paid. So it's pretty clear that he's not facing the punishment that he deserves.
Yeah. What about the Fred Thompson and the base, Owen Robinson, wanted Louis Libby pardoned? Why not pardon him?
I think that right now Bush is waiting for the appeals process to finish. I think the commutation was a goal just to keep Libby out of jail because the appeals court had ruled that Libby should go to jail while the appeal went forward. And Bush is looking to get make sure Libby stays out of jail until the appeals process is complete. And I suspect that at the end of Bush's term, we're very likely to see a pardon of Libby. As far as the base is concerned, quite frankly, I agree with them. I think this prosecution was a complete farce, completely politically motivated, and it's really kind of a joke. At the same time, looking at the political angle, I think the Republicans who are currently running for president have to love this because it takes this entire issue off the table. No longer are they going to have to face questions at debates about whether or not they're going to pardon or commute Scooter Libby. It's already been done. So I think it really actually helps many of the presidential candidates.
Ruth Conniff, you think the pardon is just months away?
Why not at this point? I mean, I think that it's true, as Owen said, that it shows that Bush doesn't really care. His approval ratings are in the toilet anyway. And, you know, there were a lot of people who thought he'd wait till after the election and then pardon Libby. The fact that he's willing to do this now shows that, you know, it's just bald-faced. You know, you fall on your sword, you commit a crime for Bush, and you get off. So, you know, it's pretty clear that he's not too concerned about public opinion on this. And I don't know that it helps the Republican presidential candidates. You know, like it or not, they are associated with their party and with the wrongdoing of the party. And this kind of just flagrant disregard for the very principles that they held up, you know, remember restoring honor and dignity to the White House and, you know, that phrase, the rule of law that we heard ad nauseum in the late 90s. You know, it's just not, you know, and also this is very significant. The public generally is fed up with the Iraq war. What Scooter Libby did was an effort to undermine and smear the reputation of somebody who was a critic of the Iraq war and who pointed to the phony use of intelligence in order to support that war, which we all now know was, you know, we were being misled. The public was being misled. So I think that's significant to people. It's not like the Clinton era when people were sick of hearing about Monica Lewinsky, and in the end it was basically, you know, a story about an affair. This is a story about how we got to the point that we're at in this country. We're involved in this tremendously unpopular and bloody and endless war.
Well, Ruth, I think quite honestly you're stretching the reality a little bit there. Libby was not convicted of releasing any information regarding anybody. He was convicted of perjury for not remembering properly a conversation he had 3 years prior about that issue. But the truth is that Armitage, who is a Bush enemy from the State Department, actually admitted to leaking that information to the press. And I don't think anybody can claim that Armitage was somehow a tool or an arm of the Bush administration. He has always been against the Bush administration. So, you know, it's worth noting that Libby was not convicted of revealing anybody, any CIA operative's name or trying to smear anybody's reputation. He was convicted of not remembering a conversation from many years prior about that issue.
Well, I wouldn't argue that Libby was a fall guy and that he, you know, he was the one who was sent out there with the cover-up and, you know, ended up taking the heat for that, that Cheney was involved, most likely, that, you know, Fitzgerald said repeatedly
that
there was a cloud over the vice president, that they couldn't get the goods on him. and that Armitage should probably be investigated as well, that Karl Rove was involved. Even Tony Snow has said that the vice president may have been involved. So, you know, I think it's clear that there was it's you know, typical that the cover-up is what gets people in trouble.
Yeah. Let me take a short pause as we remind listeners, this is the Friday Week in Review. Our guests, Ruth Conniff, political editor for The Progressive Magazine, and Owen Robinson, blogger for bootsandsabers.com, columnist for the West Bend Daily News, talking with us about the news of the week. We'll take a few calls on the Lewis Libby story, and then we'll move on to other issues. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Hope you join in our Friday Week in Review with an issue from the news this week that you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our first caller is Kathy in East Troy. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I may sound like I'm a total conspiracy nut here, but I'm thinking there's a reason why they commuted Mr. Libby's sentence as opposed to pardoning him. If he had been pardoned and then subpoenaed by the Senate or anyone else to get further information, he would not be able to plead the Fifth in order to avoid testifying. However, if he was simply commuted, he would be able to say, well, I plead the Fifth because I don't want to jeopardize my ongoing case, which is an appeal status. I'd like to have some comments about that.
Do you think that's the case, Owen Robinson?
No, I don't think so, because the issue of double jeopardy on a crime already applies whether or not he's pardoned. He's still been prosecuted and convicted of that crime, and, you know, the Fifth really doesn't apply at that point unless he's pleading the Fifth regarding some other crime he may have committed, but I don't think there's any evidence of that. I really do think this is just a matter of Bush truly thinking the sentence against somebody he obviously knows and considers a friend and respects was incorrect, and he's looking to keep him out of jail. It's as simple as that.
Let me get you, Ruth, to respond to what Lance has to say. Lance and Antioch, you're on the air.
Yeah, Owen made the point that I was originally calling about, that there was no underlying crime. They found out that Richard Armitage was the person who leaked the name, and the three-judge panel and Fitzgerald himself said that there was probably no crime committed. She may or may not have been an undercover covert CIA agent. Nobody really knows. The law was very narrowly defined. So nobody even knows if a crime was committed, and they knew that from day one. And that's the tragedy of this case, that he went on for another 2 years trying to get somebody to slip up, trying to get somebody to accidentally or purposely lie under oath just so that he could get a conviction and continue his job for 2 years. It's ridiculous. The person they should have been going after was Sandy Berger. He actually destroyed and stole documents. And what, he got a $10,000 fine, no time in jail, and he's probably going to be working in the State Department once again when Hillary's elected?
Yeah. Ruth Conniff?
Well, yeah, I remember the famous Sandy Berger stuffing documents in his pants case in the National Archives. I mean, it just, you know, people see this stuff through their own political filter, but it's so ironic given the great umbrage over the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky case. You know, I mean, what was that underlying crime? You know, and what was the issue of grave national concern there? This clearly rises to that level of serious national concern. And, you know, lying to the FBI is a crime. And Scooter Libby's a lawyer. And, it's, you know, it's pretty serious. It's pretty serious, you know, for our nation, for the fact that we can't trust the intelligence reports that we're getting from this administration. You know, I would just refer people to this four-part series in the Washington Post on Dick Cheney, which is just incredible to see the level of secrecy. You know, in this dark compound where Scooter Libby worked, you know, in the vaults for daily documents where they kept everything super secret. You know, and it turns out that there was this whole long-term plan to pass off false information, false intelligence to the American people to get us into this war. That is the underlying concern here, the public concern, and there's certainly a crime committed, and he was convicted of it. So, you know, I don't see the reason for umbrage at his at his sentence.
Let's take a quick trip to Iowa, also in the news this week.
She'll be a great president of the United States, Senator Hillary Clinton.
So Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail together in Iowa this week. I want to talk to both of you a little bit about a couple of different issues involving Bill and Hillary, including something that was alluded to a little bit earlier in the program. Both did speak to reporters about the commutation of Louis Libby's sentence, and both criticizing President Bush for taking this step. That is a little risky for the Clintons to make this a campaign issue, isn't it, Ruth Conniff, when President Clinton made so many controversial pardons at the end of his term?
Yeah, they have to address it. They have to address it because it would be so transparently bad if they didn't. But it really comes at a bad time when Hillary has just gotten Bill to come with her and stand next to her on stage in Iowa so frequently, and then she has to address this particular issue as he stands there. Maureen Dowd had a very catty column about it in the New York Times that's reprinted this morning in the State Journal. And, it doesn't look great. It doesn't elicit people's fondest memories of the Clinton administration. But what can they do? They got to talk about it.
Yeah. But on the other hand, Owen Robinson, people say the Clinton pardons, he wasn't pardoning anybody that supposedly could implicate him in some sort of illegal activity, which is what many Democrats are saying President Bush did when he did this with Louis Libby.
Well, the problem with that statement is it rests on an assumption that there is some crime that was committed by Bush, and no one has indicated that, or no one has any evidence pointing that. Fitzgerald investigated that issue for years. So, you know, I don't see where that holds water. Meanwhile, you know, many of Clinton's pardons were, you know, relatives of Hillary and, you know, friends and campaign contributors who probably have plenty of dirt on Clinton. But again, the issue is just that, you know, obviously the Clintons really don't have a lot of room to criticize here. But you know who I think this helps the most is Barack Obama. Because he is building his campaign on, you know, we need a change and look at the future and really focusing on the future and trying to paint Hillary as someone from the past. They're old news. They're, you know, been there, done that. We don't want to do that again. So I really think that this issue helps Barack the best. And I think you probably see a little bump for it.
What do you think, Ruth Conniff?
Well, I do think that that's an important point, that the Mark Rich pardon is very different from the Scooter Libby pardon in that it was, you know, gross. It was, you know, a favor handed out to somebody who had made campaign contributions and who was a corrupt businessman. But it didn't stop the investigation of wrongdoing by an administration. And that's very important because really granting clemency to Scooter Libby, it does shut the door on finding out what else is going on. And since people on the right and the left think that Scooter Libby was basically a fall guy and that this whole plan to uncover, to reveal the identity of a CIA agent, which you would think conservatives would not favor, and to, you know, attack political enemies for telling the truth about weapons of mass destruction, you know, we should know. We should know who else was involved, and we won't because of Bush's decision. So he's intervening in something that affects him directly, which is different from just doing a favor, you know, which smacks of political corruption, but is, you know, sort of transparent. It ends there.
It's not like Bush had Scooter Libby liquidated in some Stalinist plot or anything. He's still alive. He can still be... he can still be subpoenaed. He can still be put under oath. If people want to investigate, they can continue to investigate.
But he knows that his friend can come up with $250,000 in 24 hours and that he now doesn't have to do any jail time. So what's his motive for, you know, he's got plenty of motive to stay loyal and very little not to.
Yeah. What about the talk about whether this hurts or helps Hillary Clinton's campaign to have the former president on the road with her? Does he outshine her, Ruth Conniff?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that people most often note about Bill and Hillary Clinton is how much more charismatic Bill Clinton is mm-hmm. and how wooden Hillary seems standing next to him. And, you know, for people like me and, you know, progressives, it's you know, we went through the experience of two terms of Clinton, who would talk as if he were a great progressive and sort of make you believe it. You know, he could sell the idea that he was really going to, you know, enact some progressive policies, and then in fact he was the president of triangulation. Well, Hillary Clinton comes out and you can just see the triangulation just transparently, you know. And one of the mysteries about Hillary Clinton is why she inflames the right so much. You know, the right likes to talk about her as if she were this, you know, communist, and in fact she is she's a radical centrist. You know, she's very very conservative socially. She's, you know, talked about the tragedy of abortion. She's talked about, you know, she supports a law against flag burning. She talks about, you know, cleaning up the internet and does those things very in a very calculated manner. Comes out, stands next to Joe Lieberman, talks about these sort of socially conservative policies in order to avoid talking about the Iraq War when that was awkward for her. So it's transparent with her. You know, where Clinton is kind of amazing in how he could get people to love him and believe that he was on their side. You know, Hillary doesn't have that magic, and what you're left with is the kind of, you know, warmed over third way politics of the Clinton administration, which doesn't excite anybody. It doesn't excite, you know, the base of the Democratic Party, and yet she draws all this hatred from the right. So I think that that is the problem, and I think bringing Bill in kind of, you know, throws that into sharp relief.
Yeah. Owen Robinson?
You know, this has been a problem since the beginning of the Hillary campaign. And, you know, it's really kind of new to our political dialogue, our political landscape. What do you do when the spouse of an ex-president is running for president? What do you do with the ex-president? And I think you've seen the Hillary campaign go through a couple different ideas with how to use Bill. Everything from, you know, shipping him off overseas to do speeches to stay out of the way, to walking hand in hand with Hillary down a street in Iowa. Bill does bring a different dynamic to the campaign. He does risk overshadowing Hillary, where people will begin basing their judgments on Hillary on their impressions of Bill, whether good or bad. But what Bill Clinton does bring to the Hillary campaign are two things. One, the fundraising. Bill Clinton is still a tremendous fundraiser, and also just as a crowd draw. Hillary's crowds in Iowa this last week were the largest she has ever had because Bill was with her, even if some in the crowd confused him for Bob Barker. But that was a funny little story. But he's a tremendous draw, and I think you see a clear calculation just by the fact that they were walking hand in hand, not just together, hand in hand down the street, that Hillary has clearly decided she wants to use his prowess for campaigning out there. But again, I do think that this is another thing that kind of comes back and helps Obama, because it does remind people that, oh yeah, Hillary is the wife of Bill Clinton, and do we want to revisit the Clinton years, or are we ready for a change?
You know, another candidate, some bad news on the campaign trail. A lot of talk just yesterday that John Edwards is not fundraising as much as he should, but also in the news is that his Beverly Hill hairstylist says that he has been paid up to more than $1,200 for haircuts, which included travel expenses, so he could give the $400 haircut or haircuts. John Edwards making poverty a, you know, big issue in his campaign doesn't look too good, giving his stylist $1,200 for a haircut, does he, Ruth Conniff?
I don't know. This haircut story never goes away, and it, you know, it's like the rabbit that swam out to attack Jimmy Carter. I think, you know, it has some kind of resonance for people that somehow John Edwards is not masculine and is a pretty boy. You know, the fact is, all of these guys spend an awful lot of money on things like airbrush spray makeup and, you know, the green room video that made the rounds on YouTube where Edwards is, you know, having his hair styled and looking in the mirror. I mean, everybody who's been on TV knows that you sit there with people fussing over you and you have absolutely nothing to do but wait. So I think that it's a non-issue substantively, but it clearly is a problem for Edwards.
Yeah.
And as far as being the candidate of poverty, you know, I thought that Elizabeth Edwards, when she was here in Wisconsin, did a good job of dealing with that issue because, you know, she said, yes, you know, he's been very successful, and he didn't come from that, and he doesn't want to pull the ladder up behind him, and he's done a lot, you know, in his home mm-hmm. state to try to extend college for everyone, you know, to pay for people in a certain section of North Carolina to get into college and have a year paid for free. You know, he talks about the American dream and how we have cut away at the ability of people who, like him, you know, come from nothing to work their way up. So I think Americans like that story generally, and I don't think that that part of it is, I don't think that it's hypocrisy, and I don't think it sounds so much like hypocrisy. I think what it is it's the continuing theme of, you know, when they called him the Breck girl in the last mm-hmm, campaign, mm-hmm. The, you know, this idea that of somehow undercutting his masculinity, which is, you know, that's the political weapon, that's sort of the swift boating technique that they've decided to try to use against Edward.
Owen Robinson?
Well, there clearly are two Americas, and we know which one Edwards lives in. You know, for me, he's a wealthy man. If he wants to spend $1,200 to get a haircut, it's no skin off my back. I don't care. I think the real issue here is not how much he spent on the haircut, although I do think that that is, it makes for fun political fodder, which is why it has some, you know, such long legs. But the issue is that he used campaign funds for it, where you sit back and think about the, you know, the blue-collar car worker who sent Edwards $50 to help get him elected, and to know that that went to some Hollywood hairstylist so he could get his hair, you know, cut in Atlanta, is just it's kind of offensive. It's kind of a slap in the yeah. face to his contributors, and I think that probably is one of the things that's causing some contributors to hold back their money and say, look, you're wealthy, fund your own campaign, because I'm not paying for any more of your haircuts.
I'm going to pick on a Republican candidate now. The presidential campaign of Senator John McCain is in trouble this week. It said that it wasn't raising the money it was supposed to, and it's going to dismiss dozens of workers and aides and retool its strategy on where to compete. John McCain's campaign is in trouble. Owen Robinson?
Well, McCain's candidacy was always weak. He had strong support in the media because he's always pandered to the media, but frankly, he had very, very little support from the base, and frankly quite a bit of hostility from much of the base because of his support of the campaign finance stuff. Then he goes off being one of the most militant senators in support of Bush on the war, which, although I agree with his stance there, it's clearly not a position that helps him politically. And then what really drove the final nail in the coffin was his position on this debacle of an immigration bill, which, again, particularly with the base, but also with a lot of other people, are just clearly on the wrong side of that issue. And you kind of put all those things together, and he has no base support. The left, sir, isn't going to support him. He doesn't have a base of support other than a few sycophants. So I think it's pretty clear at this time that McCain's candidacy is dead. I don't see him going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Ruth Conniff?
Well, I agree. I think it's ironic, though, that the architect of campaign finance reform, along with our own Senator Russ Feingold, is done in by his inability to fundraise, largely from corporate interests mm-hmm. that he's criticized. You know, and it's too bad. That part of it is, I think, revealing about our political system. And you know, it's just, this is the truth about money in politics. It's just exploding, and unless you have an incredible amount of money that can be raised only from very powerful corporate interests, you're not viable. And that's exactly what McCain and Feingold got a lot of traction talking about and trying to do something about, and yet, you know, you can't stay in the race if you don't compete on that level. So it's an impossible situation. I don't think that's the only problem for McCain, though. I think that Owen's right. He never appealed to the socially conservative base. They always looked at him with a fisheye. They thought, you know, is he a real social conservative or not? And then he just seemed kind of like he was getting a little cranky in this campaign, mm-hmm. you know, when he made a couple of weird statements like that bomb, 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 Iran.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And the walk through Baghdad talking about how safe it was. I mean, it was really not credible. He hasn't campaigned well. And so, you know, his star is fading. I think by supporting Bush on the war so avidly and by having to swallow his pride in a way that was just disgusting to, you know, make common cause with this president, and even at the end of the last election to campaign with him after the really dirty politics that the Bush people used against McCain in South Carolina saying, you know, suggesting that he had an illegitimate black child because of the child they adopted from India. You know, there's genuine hatred there. I mean, to be treated that way by somebody and then have to walk around sort of smiling for photo ops and throw your support behind that person and then during this administration become a supporter of Bush, I think really undermines what was charming about McCain, the straight talk, the idea that he was a real guy, that anyone could, you know, get a straight answer from him. And that, you know, only in at that level of politics do you see that kind of unimaginable, you know, recovery from grotesque personal attack and insult. I mean, that I think undermined him.
We are talking with Ruth Conniff, political editor for The Progressive Magazine, Owen Robinson, blogger for bootsandsabers.com, columnist for the West Bend Daily News, reviewing the news of the week. After this short break, we'll talk about a longtime Republican senator who is withdrawing his support for President Bush's Iraq policy. Plus, we'll talk about a proposal to put on Wisconsin's ballot a referendum question to withdraw troops from Iraq. 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 are numbers if you would like to join us for the Week in Review. Bring up a topic of your choice. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
However difficult the fight in is Iraq, we must win it. We must succeed for our own sake. For the security of our citizens, we must support our troops. We must support the Iraqi government, and we must defeat al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Well, it was President Bush on the 4th of July talking about the war in Iraq. And shortly after that, we hear the news that a longtime Republican senator is withdrawing his support for the president's Iraq policy and joining a growing number of GOP lawmakers who are abandoning the president's strategy. This one, New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, is now supporting a proposal to bring home most of the troops by March. What do you think of that, Owen Robinson?
Well, everybody's general, aren't they? You know, I think there are there are two issues, really, major issues with the Iraq war when it comes to the domestic politics behind it. One is whether or not you agree with the strategy, whether you agree with the Bush doctrine that we should be offensive and project our power to where terrorists are and kill them there versus, you know, not waiting for them to attack and responding. The second issue has to deal with tactics. How do we go about prosecuting the war? And I think it's with the tactical considerations in Iraq where Bush and his Pentagon have clearly made some grievous errors and I think compounded those without being as frank and open about those errors with the public as he could have been. At the same time, you have to note that if looking at Iraq right now and the surge that's going on, the so-called surge, which is just starting to get geared up to get the people over there, which is having some real positive effects. And if you look at the General Petraeus, clearly has a new strategy for handling or a new tactical method for dealing with Iraq, and it's having some positive results. But we're not going to see the fruits of those results for quite some time, several months, if not years. And so at this point, you have to evaluate what's going on in Iraq with what is working and what is not, rather than trying to set everything against this, your perception of whether you like President Bush or not.
Ruth Conniff?
Well, I think the American people are pretty sure that they don't like the Iraq war. And part of the reason that they don't like President Bush, and in fact that his poll numbers are, you know, in the low 20s, just, you know, where Nixon was right before he left office, is largely because of this war. I mean, the constantly shifting justifications for the war don't help. Never mind tactics. We went over there because there were supposed to be weapons of mass destruction. There was supposed to be an imminent threat to the United States. There was none. And then it was because, you know, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, which he was. And then, you know, we were going to be greeted as liberators, which we weren't. And now it's not clear what's going on. We're in the middle of a civil war. It's dragging on forever. Domenici, who's up for re-election next year, basically said what a lot of people, you know, find obvious, which is we don't have indefinite patience for this. This thing's gone on longer than World War II, and people are continuing to die, and there's no clear exit, there's no clear, you know, finish line, or even a great definition of success. You know, there's no sense that we'll ever realize the neocon dream of setting up this, you know, wonderful example of democracy and functional government over there. So now it just becomes a question of how many more Americans are going to die and how many more Iraqis are going to die before we just get out of there, and how do you unwind this thing? How does the U.S. save face? So, you know, obviously there's very low enthusiasm for it, and it's evidenced by various Republicans who are up for re-election starting to defect, and the argument is just over how do we withdraw? And as far as fighting al-Qaeda there instead of here, of course, al-Qaeda wasn't there until the United States troops were. So now we have, you know, a situation where we're creating a new front and fertile ground for recruiting for al-Qaeda. And the blowback from that, as the English are certainly well aware, is scary thing to contemplate.
Yeah, we will talk about that, too. I hope we have time. Willie in Madison, though, on more on Pete Domenici, Willie?
Yeah, among other things. First of all, Ruth, I need to correct your use of verb tense. Saddam became a bad guy. We mustn't forget that he was sort of our fair-haired kaffir boy back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when we supported him, helped him get into power. Yeah, we mustn't forget that he is our creation, like Noriega, probably like Mobutu. Pete Domenici's thing, though, and let me correct your other guest, too. You said General Petraeus. You need to pronounce that more carefully because I agree he's betrayed us, you don't, and you probably should pronounce the P more clearly. Blame the victim is what Pete Domenici is doing. You know, he's saying these Iraqis are just not doing the job. You know, well, they were the best Iraqis we could hire. They were the best puppet government we could hire there. And they can't possibly, with the political realities, do exactly what the proconsuls or viceroys want them to do. And so guys like Domenici, these cowards, now are blaming them.
Yeah. Thank you, Willie. Ruth Conniff?
That's right. It's worth remembering, you know, the infamous photos of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein and the fact that the U.S. did support him during the time that he was committing some of the terrible acts that we later used as a justification for going to war with him, like gassing the Kurds. I mean, that was back in the 80s when we were on his side. So, I mean, I do think that that's worth remembering. But and I also agree, and this was one of Hillary Clinton's lines that she's taken up, oddly enough, from the right, is to say that the Iraqis need to pull up their socks, a la Donald Rumsfeld again, you know, and they need to step up. And the real problem in Iraq is that, you know, the Iraqis aren't good enough. And, you know, it is blaming the victim. And it is, you know, ignoring how ill-conceived the war was at the outset and the idea that by, you know, bombing Baghdad back to the Stone Age, we could create this laboratory for democracy and the whole place was going to, you know, look like France in no time.
Owen Robinson?
Well, wow, I've had two lengthy strings of talking points. It's hard to refute them all. But, it is worth remembering that in the past, America did have a foreign policy based on supporting other governments that were friendly to us almost regardless of how they treated their own people. That was a Cold War foreign policy process or methodology. And what the Bush administration has done is changed that. And that's one of the fundamental changes in America's foreign policy that's happened since the 9/11 attack, was no longer is America always willing to prop up a dictator in a foreign nation just because that dictator is friendly to us and not Russia. We are now going in and actually trying to spread democracy, spread freedom, and spread those things around the world. And whether you agree or not with that foreign policy decision, you have to recognize that it is different than how America prosecuted foreign policy in the past. At the same time, I find this notion that it cannot be done to be somewhat offensive, because it either suggests that, A, people don't want to be free, or B, they're too stupid to do it. And I think that kind of condescension is quite offensive. It's clear that in nations like Germany and Japan and Italy and a host of other nations, America has had quite some success going in and helping nations develop a representative form of government and be freer. And I think that, and here we get back to the issues of strategy versus tactics. Clearly, many of our tactics in Iraq were wrong. You know, you talk about bombing Baghdad back to the Stone Age. We did nothing of the sort. In fact, we were extremely selective in targets in going after that war, which many people considered to be a tactical error because it left in place too much of the infrastructure for the insurgents or the terrorists to be able to use against us. Whereas if we had just bombed them back to the Stone Age, at least we'd be starting with a clean slate. So,
I don't think it's condescending to the Iraqis to say that the U.S., the very overbearing U.S. involvement there was ill-fated from the beginning. I mean, it's one thing to support an indigenous movement for democracy, and it's another to go and say that you're going to impose democracy at gunpoint. You know, never mind the situation.
I need to move on to a related issue, but we're running short on time, and we didn't get to many of the issues that we need to. Democratic State Representative Dave Travis, a Democrat of Madison, wants to give all of us a say in whether the U.S. should withdraw troops from Iraq. He is trying to get a referendum placed on the ballot, the February 2008 presidential primary ballot, that would read, should the United States withdraw its troops from Iraq? What do you think of that, Owen Robinson?
It's another meaningless, non-enforceable referendum. Who cares? There have been cities and whatever passing these around for years now. It's clearly not going to change Bush's mind. I don't see how it has any impact whatsoever on the debate, more than, hey, we did a poll and people don't support the war.
Ruth Conniff?
Well, I think it's great. I think that was Bob La Follette's vision. La Follette thought that having the right to declare war belong to Congress was not enough, that it should go to a plebiscite, and the people should have a voice. After all, you know, it's the people who are over there and their loved ones who are over there fighting the war. So I think to the extent that this becomes a national movement and that around the country people insist on making their voices heard, that should put pressure on the federal government, and eventually it does.
But it isn't a plebiscite. It's a non-enforceable, meaningless, non-binding referendum.
Right. We don't have a plebiscite, but
so
it's in the
Bob
spirit
LaFollette
of...
didn't get his way.
It's in the spirit of that, and I think that it's a role that people can play. People are frustrated that they don't have a voice in this and that they were misled into this war, and here's an opportunity for them to speak out about that, and it should matter that 72% of Wisconsinites want to get out of Iraq because
we have a lot of people
serving over there.
They have a voice for it. They can call their elected representatives, and quite frankly, that would have much more effect than some idiotic, you know.
Well, I agree with you that they should do that as well.
Yeah. Let's talk about the bombings or attempted bombings in the UK earlier this week. About eight doctors, physicians, are in custody for being suspected and being involved with this. And it's suspected that Al-Qaeda was recruiting these physicians, thinking it would be easier to get these physicians into other countries to carry out these types of actions. How worried are you about this, Owen Robinson?
Well, I think it's, you know, we've seen numerous terrorist attacks ongoing all over the world for years now, from the train bombings in Spain to the subway bombings there in London. It's just a reminder that there are people out there who do want to kill us because of our civilization, because of Western principles. And I think it's especially when this comes on, you know, the brand new ascension of the Prime Minister Gordon Brown. It's very clear that terrorists don't really care who the Prime Minister of Britain is and whether or not they have an aggressive policy on Iraq or on the war on terror or whether they call it the war on terror. Clearly, the terrorists don't care one whit about that. They want to kill, people, you know, the British and the Americans and people who hold up Western civilization precisely because of who we are, not because of what we've done.
Yeah. Ruth Conniff?
Well, I mean, I think that's a dangerous, it's a dangerous analysis because it doesn't take into account why we're seeing this now when we weren't seeing it before. And if you ask the bombers, they say it was revenge for the destruction of, you know, one bomber said it was revenge for the destruction of his family's property fortune in Iraq. Another said that, you know, he was going to keep fighting to end the bombing and torture of his people. I mean, clearly, this is blowback, and it's an unintended consequence of the Iraq war, and it really puts the lie to the idea that we are fighting there to avoid fighting at home. We are stirring up, and the British along with us are stirring up hatred that could last for a generation and more. And so we really need to think about, and The Guardian had a good analysis piece on this yesterday, talking about how dangerous it is, the trend in Britain, to lump all Islamists together to say, you know, they hate us because of our freedom, as Bush said right after 9/11, and not to take a more careful and nuanced view and understand, you know, what our role is in this and what we can do to try to unwind it.
Well, I've heard this analysis for years that it's stirring the pot and causing blowback, but quite frankly, we weren't in Iraq or Afghanistan when the USS Cole was bombed, when they bombed the World Trade Center in 93 or on 9/11.
No, we were in Saudi Arabia. I mean, there was
there have been many clear statements about this.
Yeah. We only have a couple of minutes left. The State Assembly is back in session next week after taking this holiday week off, and will take up the state budget. The State Senate passed its version 2 weeks ago. Owen Robinson, I saw a piece where you wrote about some 50 billion reasons to not like the budget that was passed by the State Senate.
Well, boy, I wish we had more time for
this.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
The issue itself, the socialized health care that they're putting forth is almost meaningless discuss because they're not serious about it. The Senate Democrats know for a fact that this was never going to get through the Assembly, and in fact, even Governor Doyle is not supporting it, saying he lives in the real world. And you can see that it's a pure political ploy because they gave it precisely one day before voting to double the state's tax burden, which is just not even any kind of public input or deliberation or thought process. This was thrown in there for two reasons. One, to let the Senate Democrats run on this issue next year where they can run campaign ads saying that we tried to fix health care and those nasty, mean old Republicans stopped us. And the second issue is to draw attention away from the nearly $3 billion in tax increases beyond this that they have in their budget, a 9% tax increase that's sitting in that budget that has nothing to do with this health care proposal.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Ruth Conniff, sorry I don't have time for your response to that. We'll talk more about the state budget issues in our state capitol report after 7 o'clock on Monday, though. Ruth Conniff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Owen Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth, and thank you, Joy.
Ruth Conniff, political editor for The Progressive, Owen Robinson, blogger for bootsandsabers.com. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.